Hello there, my name is Betsy Woodruff. I'm a reporter with the Washington Examiner. I focus on campaigns, and I'm here with my good friend Daniel Strauss, who has a very similar beat over at Talking Points Memo. And we are excited to have a delightful conversation today about a number of interesting campaign things. And but first off, I kind of wanted to complain a little bit about, I don't want to name names, and I don't want to specifically go after people or outlets that cover these people, but with the beheading of this reporter by ISIS today, or the reported beheading, you know how this goes. You're on Twitter and you see somebody say something terrible, and it's practically a countdown till a major media outlet writes, "You won't believe what this person says," and then the tweet goes viral, and then we all have to be upset about a random person who's not that important, who does not have a very big national media platform, but for whatever reason said something really irritating on the internet, and now it's news. I find this very irksome and very unhelpful, and it makes me mad. Do you have any thoughts on this, Daniel?
Well, this connects into the larger sort of problem with breaking news in the age of the internet, which is that when something really horrible happens, there's a well of shock value and hate clicking, basically, to farm.
Yeah.
It's like a rush to find out if there's a horrible shooting or beheading, who these people are and were they terrible, and, find the person's Facebook and a person's name on the Facebook and just post it up there and just comb through everything else so long as you can find something bad. We saw this with Ferguson. We've seen this with past shootings. And the latest thing is sort of, today there was definitely a rush with this horrible beheading again of partisans sort of trying to twist that into the other side. We highlighted, I think, a Democrat who said Republicans were worse than ISIS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
there's
great job, winner.
Yeah.
All aboard the Smart Take Express.
What could go wrong here? This is one thing that I just don't. There are certain things, Betsy, that are like they could, do well if you're a candidate or for your side, but like the likelihood that they'll blow up in your face is just so much higher. It's like invoking the Holocaust or Hitler. Like, never works out.
Right.
I never understand. And this is one of those things. I did want to ask you, what did you think of the Snap coverage of this today and the Snap responses and questions?
One thing that I thought was really good was that people stayed away from showing the video of the beheading. I think that's really, really admirable. It's just, it seems like it's unhelpful. Everybody knows what a beheading is, and broadcasting these images is probably better for ISIS than it is for anyone else, although I understand opinions vary on that. But I appreciated that wasn't something that was all over the place. I also, Justin Green, our social media guy, tweeted, "Heads up to social media editors, make sure you check the comments of your posts, because internet trolls who clearly need to get hobbies are posting the full video, like, on different media outlets' Facebook pages." I find that just astonishing. I thought it seemed good. I thought, with a couple exceptions, that unfortunately we've gotten kind of good at covering this stuff, which is a very not an ideal predicament to be in, obviously. But
There's been a collective relearning in the age of the internet of how to cover something horrible like this, where, three editors don't look on the lead story on A1 before it goes out, and you have a night to prepare and check everything.
Right.
I think there is a collective sort of pause in a different way on this.
Yeah, sure thing. I think here's what I was thinking about to what I was getting at earlier. And I think this is a good analogy, is right after the Boston bombings, when Alex Jones said all that kooky stuff about it being a false flag and the government's trying to take our guns, and everyone was like, wow, let's all write stories about Alex Jones. And I wrote a story about Alex Jones. I wrote a piece, an essay at National Review that I think is good. That, you know, I reread it and I'm like, yeah, it's a good thing. I'm glad I wrote that. But Alex Jones said a whole bunch of crazy stuff that disqualified him from being taken seriously by national media. And I think for the most part, people get that. And we no longer talk about him like he's a serious person or like he's a person who's wacky comments should be news. If you're the Democratic Senate nominee for Iowa, or if you're a cabinet member, or if you chair the RNC or whatever, and you say something wacky, it's news, right? But if you're a random internet person who has a couple thousand Twitter followers and a bone to pick, and you say something wacky, like that doesn't need to be written up because there's a finite number of reporters in the world. And I don't know. I just maybe it's just a pet peeve, I guess. It's not that obviously not the worst thing that could ever happen.
I don't think it is. I think there is more. I mean, there is more. The thing is, and this actually ties into our primary beats. There is less access to candidates, so it is harder and harder to show your readers or your audience what one side or the other is saying. Mm-hmm. And so that's why there is harvesting of pundits and sort of lesser-known figures who aren't elected officials but hold some sort of very minor role in, like, the conservative or the democratic movement. Mm-hmm. I want to say that I think, you know, calling out some people who are not elected officials but are definitely in the public sphere is important. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a fine line to walk. Like, there are definitely... Like, sometimes, I think we try at TPM just to make sure that whoever we're highlighting does indeed represent a side. It's not just someone trying to get attention as much as we can.
Right. That makes sense. I think that's a good gauge to use.
Right. It's not always easy, but I definitely understand where you're coming from here. Yeah. I think more of that is going to happen as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Okay, so we, having had that good warm up, we wanted to talk about, I guess, four big campaign stories. And the first, and I just think this is a fascinating situation that played out over Memorial Day weekend, is with Mark Begich, who's the Democratic Senate candidate in Alaska. He had to pull, as far as I can tell, this was the first Senate ad that was pulled this cycle. News broke today that he was taking this ad down. And the whole thing, sort of the story unwound over Labor Day weekend. So I have just a heart full of compassion for everybody involved in this saga whose three-day weekend was kind of spoiled by the unfolding story. But basically, the very short Cliff Notes version is a couple of years ago, a man named Jerry Active broke into a home, this is in Anchorage, I believe, murdered an elderly couple, and then sexually assaulted their two-year-old granddaughter, which is a really horrible crime. I mean, hard to think of a crime that is more evil and more horrific than that. And the Begich campaign found a way to tie this crime to Dan Sullivan's tenure as Attorney General. And there's a really big, protracted, lengthy debate between the Sullivan folks and the Begich folks over whether or not Sullivan had any culpability, whether or not someone in Sullivan's Attorney General office should have been more careful about giving Jerry Active a plea deal. And I should asterisk that it's an alleged crime since Jerry Active is in prison and hasn't had a trial yet. It's possible he's innocent. It's alleged. So that's the important footnote there. But that's the situation that we're talking about. And you know, there's all sorts of back and forth, lots and lots of emails and press releases and stuff, competing narratives about whether or not Dan Sullivan had any culpability. Basically, though, the Begich campaign ran this ad where a retired cop drives his truck up in front of an apartment building, points to the apartment building, says, "This is the crime scene. This is where this horrible crime happened. And Dan Sullivan let sex offenders off." Essentially, the point of the ad was to fault Dan Sullivan for this murder and sexual assault. take, you know, I cover this stuff. I don't make value judgments about whether or not these ads are a good idea or ethical or acceptable. But they certainly raised a lot of eyebrows. And how this all was resolved was the attorney for the victim's family contacted the Begich campaign and sent a letter that was just blistering in its criticism. The attorney said, "I can't believe you have this ad up. This is unreal." The attorney also said that the family of the victim having to see this ad, it was making them want to leave Alaska because it was re-traumatizing for them to turn on the TV and see the building that this crime took place in. He said that Begich was using this horrible crime and this family's, you know, catastrophe for political gain. And the Begich campaign, I think they initially tried to substitute a different ad for the ad that they had up, and then they were going to try to edit it, but that ended up not working. So the ad's just been taken down fully. And I called the victim's attorney this morning, and he told me that the Begich campaign reached out to the victim's family, but that the victim's family did not return any of their phone calls, did not contact them, did not give them any sort of approbation or support in using the crime in the ad. So it's, I mean, obviously the Republicans are absolutely making hay over this. The fact that Begich has to take down the first Senate ad of the cycle is not awesome. But I'm curious, Daniel, what your thoughts are on this situation.
Was that the first ad, his first ad of the cycle?
The first Senate ad of the cycle that's run by a Senate campaign that has been taken down. As far as I know, okay. I don't know of another one.
Gotcha. I mean, I saw a tweet by HuffPost today. It was something like, or maybe it was a HuffPost reporter, which said something like, you know, Begich campaign tries to Willie Horton opponents and it backfires or something. That's mm-hmm. an allusion to Willie Horton ads against Dukakis. You know, I mean, there are a few examples of this. I know down in Texas, Wendy Davis's campaign is running sort of an attack ad against her opponent, Greg Abbott, who over his tenure on the Texas Supreme Court and tying him to a rape case there, and basically he ruled he ruled against this victim of a rape crime in opposition to the majority opinion. This is another thing. This is one of those high risk, high reward things. This is an ugly sort of thing to do, and it risks something like this backfiring. You know, I think it's a touchy topic. It is something to pay attention to. Obviously, it probably would have been better for, no, it definitely would have been better for the Begich campaign to have gone out and asked for permission first.
That seems like a no-brainer. Although Wendy Davis, the reports that I saw were that she didn't ask for permission from the rape victim to use the rape victim's story in
right.
that ad.
Right.
And
that's
clearly
right.
she didn't
so
get
think,
excoriated for that. Yeah, I think the ad's maybe
right,
still up.
Right. But and there is, I did notice that down in the paragraphs down there, they mm-hmm. say, you know, they made aware, the, you know, the victims were made aware by Texas Democrats they might use her story in the future.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
it's interesting.
Well, I mean, and the other thing I did want to highlight on this is that I need to look at the cross-section polling for this race. Alaska's a weird state because...
Weird.
Well, not weird, but Alaska is a notable state because the incidence of rape in Alaska are triple the national average.
Hmm. Wow.
And 37% of women say they've been the victims of sexual assault.
Wow.
Of sexual violence in Alaska. It's a big problem.
That's amazing.
It's really jarring.
Well,
and
Alaska has a pretty significant gender disparity, right? Like the male population
is
significantly larger than the female population.
There are far more men in Alaska than women.
And I think we tend to see these kind of sex crimes happen more often in societies with
and
those.
I think it would be, I mean, earlier in the year, Casey Hunt at MSNBC asked Sullivan and Mead Treadwell, the other sort of primary Republican candidate in the Senate race, about the Violence Against Women Act and if they'd vote to renew it. And they sort of demurred on it. So the one thing
I
would like
to
see more
of
in this...
Yeah, go ahead, and then we can go back to...
But I'm not saying that this is equivalent at all. Mm-hmm. What I am saying is that the only thing I think that's important about this, or that could have possibly been constructive, and I think we've lost it here, given that, is that this could have been a good opportunity to talk about sexual assault. And it's clearly not been handled as well as it could have.
Yeah. So now we get to talk about how not to talk about sexual assault, namely without the victim's consent.
Right. It's, it does seem like something important you would want to do, especially if you release a lot of these hard-hitting ads.
Yeah. I think part of the problem also, though, is that, and this is something that bothers me, that I've struggled with about coverage of VAWA, is that do you support reauthorization of VAWA becomes a synonym for do you oppose violence against women? Which I mean, and I just think that's an unfair shorthand. I covered the reauthorization vote last year, and the Republicans who voted against reauthorization had sound, reasonable, non-misogynist reasons to oppose reauthorization. And especially to oppose reauthorization with the provisions that were different.
Democrats have tried to at some point said, reauthorization of VAWA, therefore, you're for violence against women.
Right.
That's not always true.
Which, I mean, I would hope that's never true, given that, because if that's ever true, that means that something like 40-plus Republicans support violence against women, which, good luck making that argument. Like, I hope...
It's one of the victims of trying to shorthand difficult political topics.
Right, exactly. There are situations where there's fairly easy shorthand between what happens legislatively and what you believe. You talk about abortion votes, you talk about same-sex marriage votes. Like, these are simple, right? These are not complicated issues. But the reauthorization of VAWA and the change of some of its provisions, particularly looking at how it would change immigration law, how it could potentially affect trials and some constitutional rights that American citizens have that could potentially be infringed by tribal courts. Like, these are complicated, and they're not easy issues to talk about. Unlike, for instance, issues of abortion, which is pretty straightforward. People know what abortion is. So, I don't know. I understand how Democrats use that for messaging. I totally get it, and it makes sense. I mean, it's called the Violence Against Women Act for a reason. I get that. That's fine.
But I think it's on the onus of the reader to dig a little bit further and say, oh, well, what does that mean?
But I think it's also a reporter's responsibility not to suggest that somebody who opposes reauthorization of VAWA necessarily supports violence against women or doesn't like women. I think reporters kind of have a job to make that clear.
So let me ask you, I mean, I want to go back to Begich in a second, but how much due diligence do you think is paid to actually, when reporting on VAWA or reporting about sexual assault or these cases, how much is done in our current political reporting environments on really getting down? I mean, one thing that I found impressive in reading over your clips about the Begich thing is how much you didn't just turn it into... he said, she said, you know, rival campaigns. You really went in and looked at this case. And I think there was even a line in your initial report where you said, you know, if he had not been released early, the rape, this horrible incident wouldn't have happened.
And I mean it's possible that when he ultimately got released he would have gone and hurt someone, but he was released earlier than he would have been, and almost as soon as he was released he went out and allegedly mm-hmm. committed this crime, which is just mm-hmm. it's
so
just
how much I mean so in your experience, and you've done a little bit more on reporting on this stuff than I have, although I'm trying to get my chance as much as possible. How much due diligence is paid to sexual assault reporting and you know, sort of these ads that are somewhat connected but not really, but basically these ads and these charges that are leveled against candidates, abortion, court cases, you know, sort of Willie Horton-esque ads that are supposed to be heavy-hitting and are very, very, very serious.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the two legislative battles that are most closely tied to sexual assault are the military sexual assault reform that mm-hmm. people have been trying to push through that hasn't succeeded thus far, and then VAWA. The Violence Against Women mm-hmm. Act. And military sexual assault, at least as far as I've seen, hasn't really been a campaign issue, mostly because it's so bipartisan on both sides that it's hard for one side or the other to make hay out of it. I think at some point the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee might have sent out a fundraising email on it, maybe, but it certainly hasn't been a central theme for them. However, VAWA, yeah. I think we especially see VAWA in Kentucky. Allison Leonard and Grimes has used it to go after Mitch McConnell.
Right.
I have trouble thinking of other races where VAWA has really come up. I guess besides right. Alaska being brought up a little bit on the campaign trail in Alaska.
Yeah, and this is why yeah. I think this would have been, I mean, one of the things that really interested me in this topic and sort of the baggage thing and this thing with Treadwell and Sullivan before, I you would think both camps would be hypersensitive and hyper prepared on this topic.
Yeah, right.
And I guess that's my ultimate takeaway from this, which is mm-hmm. that having an answer ready when you're going to go or talk to an MSNBC reporter about VAWA, or checking with the family before using a story in an ad.
That seems like such a no-brainer.
Well, it's an important thing to do yeah. because this, and you know, the stats that I rolled out, I mean, this is an unusually bad problem mm-hmm. in this state. You're not going to, and I don't really understand why this keeps happening.
Yeah, seriously. And you'd think campaigns would recognize that they're talking about a problem that both is unusually widespread and also particularly grievous and horrible when we talk about sexual assault. And you'd think campaigns would recognize that and would craft their campaign ads and their campaign strategy accordingly. You would think that would happen. But apparently that's not always
the case. So why didn't that happen? Why don't you think that happened in both cases?
No idea. I mean, and no idea. I'm baffled.
I think...
And it sounds right like now. The Begich campaign called the family of the victim and asked them and didn't hear back. So sort of tried, but obviously didn't get their permission. So they had some sort of sense that they needed to reach out to the family, which they did. But obviously it's not enough just to reach out to a family. You know, you have to actually get them on board. So right. I don't know. It's nuts. Well, speaking of... I mean, there's not really an easy segue here, so never mind. I'm not going to try to segue this.
No, well, do you mind if we... Yeah, we're going to get to two more topics, but I did want to, since we're on this...
And okay, yeah.
I did want to ask you about the big news last week, which has sort of shifted away a little bit, which is Kirsten Gillibrand in excerpts of her new book.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad you brought that up.
Saying that she had been... basically harassed in the Capitol, and then being called out by a reporter. A reporter said...
A reporter who shall not be named. Her.
Yeah. I don't believe her, and there was some hubbub about that, and it went back. And she basically didn't name who someone who said something like, I like my girls chubby, mm-hmm. and another person who squeezed her waist. And she appropriately, she responded to this in the only way she could have, which is she said, thanks, asshole, and that was it.
Yeah.
The fallout, though, was there was a discussion on, I mean, there was other people who came forward and said, I definitely believe these stories, other veterans of Capitol Hill, mm-hmm. You know, not just elected officials. But I think the most shocking thing about this was that, or the most constructive part of this was that, or was meant to be that Gillibrand saying even a powerful senator, who is lauded as a very independent and inspiring woman who can have it all, is the victim of, you know, gross harassment sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think the important takeaways from that is that even if you're a U.S. senator, if it's a delicate dance, because if you suddenly say, you know, these things happen, what's going to happen to all that legislation you're trying to pass?
Right, exactly.
It's just like a tough situation to be in, and which is why I think it's important to pay close attention when someone comes forward and goes as far as Gillibrand did.
Yeah, without a doubt.
How do you think the coverage of that has been?
I thought it was good. And I guess my one thought on this issue, as a woman who reports in the
Capitol and covers in DC,
has dealt with more than my fair share of unwelcome male behavior. I think we're dealing with a problem. Like there's no woman too powerful to deal with this nonsense, which I think is the main lesson of what Gillibrand says, that dealing with this kind of nonsense is not an indicator that women are weak, right, or that they're defenseless, because if it happens to her, it can literally happen to anyone. And I think that we as a society need to do more to make it easier for women to talk about these kind of situations, so that other women know that they're not weird and they're not alone and they're not the first one that it's happened to and that they have resources. And one way that we make it easier for women, and I think telling women that they either have to talk about these situations in very, very specific detail or not talk about them at all is the opposite of helpful. I think we definitely saw some folks chastising Gillibrand for not naming the names of the senators who harassed her. And I just think that's unfounded. I think she needs to be trusted to handle this appropriately. And I imagine the men who did this to her know who she's talking about. And women need to know that they can talk about this stuff without getting excoriated publicly, you know, without jeopardizing careers or jeopardizing their jobs. So
it's funny how doing something like that, and coming forward with that creates so much more vulnerability, even though it takes so much courage to do that.
Yeah. If she named the names of these guys, there's a decent chance she would have faced a lot of backlash, which is terrible. But it probably wouldn't have helped her political career. It probably wouldn't have helped her get legislation passed.
No, you got to remember, Gillibrand is the one with the military sexual assault bill who, and we mentioned this in our last podcast, who got Ted Cruz and Rand Paul to sign up for this, and she still couldn't beat a filibuster. That is how hard. I mean, Gillibrand is one of the more liberal members in the Senate.
I think that's
so
fair, yeah.
It would be hard to, there would be a backlash, and she'd risk probably, but that's not the important takeaway.
Right.
The important takeaway is that it happened.
Right.
Unfortunately, I don't think that that was the primary focus of the coverage of this episode. I think there was some of that, but it wasn't as much as there could have been. There's a lot more like, should Gillibrand, you know, who is she talking about? Should Gillibrand name her accusers? All
right.
This stuff.
And I just think like, it's her right to, if she wants to, good for her. But I think it's ridiculous to say that women must either describe these kind of situations in very, very specific detail or not describe them at all. That's a version of a gag order. And it's just not helpful. Right. So anyway, speaking of women's issues.
So these were all stories that were well placed. We were awake. No one was on the weekend going on vacation for this. Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, there was what we call a news dump. And I don't know, I can't think of a more textbook case for a news dump than what happened at about 6:30 on Friday before a 3-day weekend, Mitch McConnell's campaign announced that his campaign manager, Jesse Benton, was resigning.
Daniel, where were you when Mitch McConnell announced his campaign manager was resigning?
Where were you, Betsy? Because I was literally just packing up and getting ready to go home. I did not have glamorous plans for the weekend.
Let me tell you where I was. I was on a Bolt bus, and my laptop was in my luggage in the bottom bin of the Bolt bus.
Oh.
And I was on my happy way up to New York to visit my boyfriend for the weekend when, surprise,
and I think I texted you.
I texted
you about it.
Yeah, he texted me about it, and I was like, what? What's going on with this?
You were one of the first people I thought of when I got a moment to breathe. This
so
is what we call a news dump.
I mean, it's a totally understandable, there's nothing wrong, it's not immoral. I imagine if I was Mitch McConnell's guys, I would do the exact same thing, but...
So the backstory here is that Benton is said to be tied to a scandal involving Ron Paul shifting his support in the 2012 presidential election, or an endorsement, and Ron Paul in the 2012.
Right, Ron Paul tried to buy an endorsement, or his campaign tried to bribe someone to endorse him in Iowa. Right. Is that right?
Right.
And I haven't followed the specific bribery allegations that closely, but
you got it. I mean, that's it. And Benton was the political director for Paul's campaign at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing to know about Benton is that he is sort of seen as a representative for the Tea Party and the Paulites.
Mm-hmm.
And McConnell, when Rand Paul, Ron's son, ran for Senate, ran against Trey Grayson, who McConnell backed.
Right.
So there's some reported tension about this, which sort of surfaced or was confirmed a year ago when McConnell... when audio surfaced of Benton saying he was holding his nose with McConnell to help Rand Paul down the line in 2016.
Right, yeah, whoops.
McConnell had to do damage control, and that was it. And in what reporting I did on the Simpson told me that, like, this resignation could have been much worse if it had to happen in the primary when Mitch McConnell had a nuisance of a primary challenger named Matt Bevin,
mm-hmm.
Who represented the Tea Party. But now he's got it locked up, so the damage is not as bad as it could have been. It came out on Friday before a three-day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And the Washington Examiner reported today that for months, Benton had not actually been the effective campaign manager. A top aide to McConnell named Josh Holmes has been the campaign manager for McConnell's reelection effort. The Grimes campaign has, like clockwork on Monday, they're issuing statements. They released a new web ad, which TPM highlighted first. Okay. They are trying to sort of capitalize on that as much as possible.
Naturally, yeah.
Betsy, I want to ask you, like, right now, is this one of these scandals that are going to stick, or are there too many moving parts? My rule with these things is that you have to be able to explain it in a sentence or two. You know, Bill Clinton, White House, Monica Lewinsky. Chris Christie, Bridge, Payback. I don't know if this is going to do it.
I don't think so. I think this is the kind of thing that is scarier for donors. If they think that the campaign is struggling or doing worse than they're told, but I imagine McConnell does not have trouble making sure that his donors know exactly what's going on. I think the long-term repercussions of this could be more significant for Rand Paul, since Benton was so close with Rand Paul. He was kind of the bridge between Rand Paul world and Mitch McConnell world, and that's been reported a lot of places. Was the guy who could be all things to all men. And if he doesn't come through this well, that could potentially be a lost resource for Rand in 2016, mm-hmm. whether he's running for president or running for re-election to the Senate.
Right. And that's one of the things that I think makes this story sort of interesting. I don't know. I got to be honest. I think I'm very interested in how the Grimes campaign responds to this because it seems like the in a campaign that's turned into very much of a grind, in a campaign cycle that's very much of a grind. This might be the last big surprising thing that happens out of Kentucky.
Interesting. Bold prediction.
Me make a bold prediction. No.
if anything else interesting happens, I'm going to text you.
I think conceivably, this might tick. I mean, if Grimes plays this right, she might be able to gain some ground.
It doesn't hurt her.
Democrats
are
very,
Democrats are very happy. It's obviously no skin off her nose.
Right. Well, right. And it also, good for Grimes, she gets to move away from this thing about her bus and her campaign bus and her father in the state that had been sort of dogging her over the week before that. You know, and the thing is that, you know, Democrats are always happy to point out that McConnell's favorables leave something to be desired in Kentucky.
Yeah.
But I don't know. But again, I'm sort of with you on this, that there are a lot of moving parts. So if someone were to tell me, you know, if like a prophet who could see the future were to tell me that doesn't work, I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah. And also, I think the average voter, especially the average, you know, off-year voter, has no idea who the campaign manager of the candidates they're voting for is, and justifiably so, because most people do not spend all day refreshing Twitter and following their favorite political operatives and keeping tabs on everyone's
careers.
I know, too bad for them. So we'll see. We'll see. Well, let's briefly get to the last two action items that we have. I know you had some thoughts on the Colorado Senate race. One thing I'm curious for your perspective on is, you know, I'm trying to get a handle on why this is so competitive, because Udall seems like a fairly non-controversial human being. You know, not really out front in the Senate, doesn't do crazy things, doesn't say crazy things, you know, doesn't run around holding hands with Harry Reid. Kind of votes the way he's expected to vote, goes home, and Colorado is, you know, purple, and probably a deep purple, I would think. And I guess I'm a little baffled as to why this race is so competitive, and it really is competitive. I think roll call put it on made Udall one of their top 10 most vulnerable senators. What do you think? What are the factors that are making it easier for the Republican nominee?
I mean,
Cory Gardner.
Purple's Ryan Lizza at the New Yorker had a really good article, I think last year or maybe a few years ago, on John Hickenlooper, the governor there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done some reporting on Colorado. It's a weird state. There are like pockets.
Also
that
weird.
Would seem...
I'd like a map of the United States with all the states
so
that you think are
most.
Weird colored in.
I use that phrase, that word, too much. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Strange.
No, it's very helpful.
Colorado is one of these states where I think it produces a lot of solid color politicians. So it produces a lot of, like, solid red politicians or solid blue politicians.
That's interesting. Kind of like Iowa and Ohio.
Yeah.
Illinois.
Yeah.
Illinois.
Maybe even more so than that, because there. I remember, you know, there are these pockets of candidates that are a little bit more to the right of where you would expect for a state out west, or out sort of in the literal Midwest, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think, I haven't gotten too much of a sense of Gardner's name recognition statewide. I think this might be one of the situations where you just have a candidate who, is not super well known, is well known but not, doesn't have a unique identity among his constituents.
Gardner or Udall?
Yeah, Gardner. Udall. An election cycle where Democrats are defending seats. I think it is a little bit surprising, and I'll be honest, I've been skeptical for a while of how close it is. Gardner, to me, before this started, always struck me as like one of those, ooh, you're a nerd, here, can you name all the rising stars in the GOP?
Pot kettle Daniel. Yeah.
I'm sorry. But Betsy, when we run into each other at parties, you know, you and I, we might talk about this, but some of the friends I watch, like Michigan football with on Saturday, are probably not going to want to talk about, like, the rising stars in the GOP or who's going to take the leadership spot.
Who's going to be a Senate contender in 2016? That's the real 2016 question.
They're missing out, too. So, yeah, I am surprised by this. And I can't really get a sense of why it is so close.
Yeah, interesting.
It is close, though. So I think, I mean, there are some races that I don't think are close. Like, I will never say that Dick Durbin is in trouble in Illinois. And there have been some polls recently that have shown that. Polling experts that I trust all are like, this is ridiculous beyond a doubt. Well, the latest thing in this race is that there was that Gardner released a new ad today, basically citing or highlighting his support for the pill and over-the-counter access to contraception. Mm-hmm.
As we noted at TBM, over-the-counter, for the pill.
Right, as we noted at TBM, this was kind of a shift for Gardner, who used to support personhood, which is very, very strict set of abortion restrictions. And the ad was a pretty clear sort of, I mean, it was clear who he was talking to. He's standing in a circle, which looks like a town hall. There are women around him nodding, looking interested, looking like they're, you know, they're listening very closely. And, you know, they're not afraid. They look like this is an important topic. And this man who's speaking to them understands that this is an important topic to them. Udall has said that while that plan has some merits, he prefers contraception under Obamacare, basically because he's worried about retail price of over-the-counter contraception that Gardner is talking about if his plan were to go through. It's sort of a weird dynamic.
That's interesting, Udall's essentially supporting less access to contraceptives for women, at least in theory.
I think the better way is to say a different plan. Because saying less access means, I think it would be, it's like saying fewer. I think right now, as I understand it, just a different plan might be more accurate. Mm-hmm. I guess. I don't know.
I guess it depends on if contraceptive prices went up. If they stayed the same.
That's the thing. And I think, frankly, Republicans who support Gardner might say that Udall would have to, supports less access for women to contraception, which is sort of what you would expect Democrats do
It's just important to read the fine print there.
And it's right.
And it's also, and the other thing here too is that I think Udall's position is very difficult to message. Gardner's position is super easy to explain. All Gardner has to say is, you're an adult, you should be able to get the pill, it should be over the counter, you can get razor blades and all sorts of dangerous things at the drugstore. Why can't you get the pill? That makes it easier for women to get. Makes it easier for women to get the contraceptive coverage that they want. That's an easy thing to explain. Right. You can explain that in a 30-second campaign commercial. And I think a lot of people intuitively understand that and think it's a good idea. But it's a lot harder, I think, for you all to say, this is why women should have to jump through a bunch of hoops and set up a doctor's appointment and take time off work and, you know, go through all this effort to get access to contraception, you know, using access not just in terms of legal barriers, but also in terms of like practical and economic barriers. I think if we're just talking about it from a purely horse race perspective, Gardner is in the a more strategic spot just for messaging.
Right. We'll see what happens. But yeah, definitely, you make a great point there. With this ad shows that he finally has figured out an effective response. Mm-hmm. If you can concisely and correctly make a point, you definitely have an advantage, especially on big policy questions.
Yeah, sure thing.
So we'll see. I mean, it's funny. The big theme of this discussion tonight, in our debut episode of Woodruff and Strauss, has been that there are these male candidates dealing with these with issues that have to do with women, and these are have been labeled as women's issues in the past. Is this? Mm-hmm. I gotta think. I know. I mean, these guys risk mansplaining, here, but I think it's. But I think at the same it's an important.
Well, I don't want Udall telling me that I should have fewer places to get birth control, right? Like, just putting myself in the position of a low information Colorado female voter. That's a very mansplaining thing to say, I would think.
Right.
I would think it's hard for him not to.
I at the same time, I mean, I think it would be nicer if we had more women candidates out there, but it's at least good that we have candidates getting into the weeds on these topics.
Hopefully getting into the weeds intelligently and without disrespecting.
Yeah, hopefully getting into the weeds intelligently. And I definitely hear you on, like, you know, it is not, right, mansplaining, there is this risk of being like, you don't know what I,
yeah,
what you
let
want.
Let me
I can tell you. Right. Yeah. I think, but please correct me if I'm wrong here, that is at least the smallest bit of constructiveness that comes out of, like, these debates and some and these goofs that have happened in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully. I don't know. Fingers crossed.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Well, we shall see. Okay. So I think we have time for one last quick hit. Looking at a campaign. This is a campaign I've done virtually no reporting on. So,
okay.
You have the talking stick. I'm all ears.
I've only done a little polling on, but or reporting on. But everyone remember Martha Coakley, the candidate who was defeated against Scott Brown in the special election for Ted Kennedy's seat. She's running for governor and is the far and away front runner. She's up something like 20 points ahead in the Democratic primary. But the general election is looking a little different. And polling has shown that it could be a tight race in deep blue Massachusetts.
Huh. Massachusetts do love their Republican governors.
Against someone named Charlie Baker. Our poll tracker average gives her a 0.6 point lead over Baker.
How big of a lead?
0.6, so 0.6.
Wow.
Which is small.
Yeah, I would say that's small.
But keep in mind, I mean, and polls have shrunk. Like, the margin of Coakley's lead has gotten much smaller, which is amazing. And it's amazing that that's happening at the same time. I mean, she hasn't gotten the nomination yet, but it's amazing that that's happening at the same time that she continues to run away with the nomination.
Huh, very odd.
So, like, I, you know, game on. I'm interested to see what happens. Like, you know.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think general election voters don't like her or like her less than we would expect?
I don't know. Maybe they're rolling the tape of the Boston Red Sox thing. I don't know. It's also interesting because Democrats are, I mean, where Republicans are said to have a slight advantage in the Senate, Democrats are the ones who seem more likely to pick up seats in governor's mansions.
Right.
This cycle.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it is kind of strange that we're seeing that. But mm-hmm. I think, I mean, it is one of those things that I think is definitely worth paying attention to. What strikes me as important is that it's not like Coakley is duking it out tooth and nail in the primaries against Senator
Steve
Grossman.
It's not like it sounds like it's not a bruising,
no, Democrats
damaging primary.
Seem
interesting,
right? And as you get closer to an election, as a rule, usually polls constrict,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
the divides happen.
Yeah.
But it's not like that's happening here. I mean, we're seeing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't, you know. Meanwhile, over in New Hampshire, Scott Brown and, I mean, polls are getting closer with Scott Brown and Jeanne Shaheen.
Hmm.
I will give you a prediction here, Betsy. I really think that Shane's going to win this because it would be so unprecedented. There have only been, I think, three senators who have represented two or more states in United States history.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I have my doubts here, but
I'm with you on that. Yeah,
they're getting close.
Yeah, if I had to guess, if I was a betting woman, I think Shaheen's gonna be well funded. I think the fact that Brown is from Massachusetts and that his name is kind of synonymous with Massachusetts doesn't do him any favors.
But it's telling. But at the same time, I mean, I'm surprised it's gotten as close as it's getting in
these
races.
Yeah, totally.
I'm surprised that it's so close in Colorado. I'm even more surprised in New Hampshire.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I don't really understand it, actually, to be honest.
The American voter is a many splendored thing. Beautiful mystery.
I mean, has divided government been so fun for Americans? I mean, you know, record lows, constant gridlock. Has this been that? Do we really want to do more of this? You know, and both sides will say no, but that's why you should elect my side,
right,
because
yeah.
we won't have divided government this time.
Right. But, and groups like No Labels that have tried to capitalize on this frustration with people fighting have basically been non-starters.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I think the kumbaya vote is probably not really showing up.
No. Okay, let me ask you a prediction thing to end this. Are we going to see any big surprises? You know, it's September now. We've got 2 months to go for the big day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and surprises are by definition unexpected, or do you, like, really think that we're just going to be... This is just going to be grinded out for the next 2 months.
I mean, I think definitely weird things are going to happen. I feel like, you know, you get to October and there's lots of feelings and emotions and nutty things happen. I hold out hope. I think where I would be surprised is the Illinois governor's race. Just that entire race is a surprise, where the Republican is up by 10 points over an incumbent Democrat or something. And we'll talk about that another day.
Yeah, so...
But,
I can actually talk about this.
Okay.
Very quickly, Pat Quinn, governor of Illinois, who's been suffering from what is quite possibly one of the most dull-sounding but very serious problems in the country, which is a pension crisis in the state, has a very serious challenge from a wealthy Republican named Bruce Rauner, who has no real serious background in politics and actually happens to be friend with Democratic Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And Rauner is in the lead. And Rauner has, I mean, TPM has highlighted this, I mean, a few times, that Rauner has said a few things that you would think are pretty damaging, but he's seemed to survive this. He said, "I'm not one of the 1%. I'm part of the 0.1%." Today,
all
Natasha
he does is win, no
Sun
matter what.
Right, Natasha Karecki of the Sun Times pointed out that that Rauner admitted that he's part of a wine club, where you have to pay $100,000 to be a member.
That sounds like a great club.
Well, I mean, you know, you got to give him props to not running from this. You know, he was
Seriously.
Asked about it. He's like, he said,
At least
I'm a member of many clubs. And the reporter said, so, yes. So does that mean you are? And he said, yeah.
At least he's not, like, awkwardly flying coach, you know?
No, well, no.
That's
well,
hard.
He wears an $18 watch, which he likes to announce. He, and there's one other thing. He has done some of the penny pinching stuff.
I always find that as soon as you start talking about how much candidates' watches cost, it's because there aren't bigger things
right.
to go after.
So one of my favorite
like,
ever John Stewart segments was a few years ago during 08, where he basically said, "I don't want someone like me. I'm a buffoon. I want someone way better than." And I think there's a point to that. That was always the appeal of basically every Democratic and Republican nominee for president, I guess. There was, or most of them, not all of them. Some of them really worked the everyman thing, but with a lot of them, sort of they're more honorable, they're smarter, they right. are more capable than I am.
We and love it, our rich people.
I guess, I mean, yeah, I think that's what it, maybe that's what's helping Rauner deep down. Americans want to think that they can be rich like Bruce Rauner.
Americans want to think that wealth is not a sign of vice. And mm-hmm. that, you know, Americans like prosperity and they like people who have a lot of money and, you know, they don't have a problem with that. I think historically, I think Americans are fairly comfortable with wealth, even generational wealth. You look at Jay Rockefeller in the Senate. You think about how Americans feel about the Carnegie family, the Kennedy family, for goodness sakes. Mm-hmm.
It's funny, yeah. It's funny.
Their antipathy towards richness, I don't think is part of the American character. Or it's at least not a dominant part, for better or for worse. And, you know, if Rauner can simultaneously be part of a $100,000 wine club, I would like to be part of a $100,000 wine club. I think it sounds awesome.
I don't know what I would say at a $100,000 wine club.
Do we think this is like one of those mailing things where like you get a wine bottle in the mail every month? Is it like that kind of
yeah,
wine club?
Yeah, so, right. Okay. So how this came about was that there was a picture taken of...
I know literally zero things about it.
Right. So there was a picture taken of Rauner with Rahm, and Rahm was holding this bottle... this wine bottle, and someone was like, hey, I know that bottle. You can only get that bottle at the $100,000 club down the street or something.
Well, Rom's not don't really tell a me how, either,
even
right?
Oppo researchers, I gotta give you props on that one.
Rahm isn't. Rahm's no little orphan Annie. He's not pinching pennies. He seems to be, you know, got elected without too much backbending.
Yeah, well, the Chicago mayor's race, I think, is going to be, and that's going to be something we got to talk about in a different day, because I got thoughts on that one.
Let's make a mental note of that.
Yeah, but I don't know how much Rauner's wealth is hurting him in this cycle. There have been a lot of attacks. Democrats have been trying to attack Rauner on where he puts money in the Cayman Islands, and I mean he's still floating, so I don't know how effective that's going to be. But yeah.
And the other thing is, like, many Democrats in Congress have money in offshore banking accounts. So many Obama bundlers have money in offshore banking accounts. Like, if having an offshore banking account disqualifies you from participating in public life, then a number of Senate Democrats are disqualified. Like, if that's the standard that we're setting, then we have to have some
serious... I think that the trick as a politician is to not necessarily be poor or be middle class, but be able to relate to the various classes, to all of them, the middle class, the wealthy, and the poor.
Seems like a good idea. And also to be defined in terms of your accomplishments rather than in terms of how much money you have or how much you spend on alcoholic beverages. So
I'm terrified to see, like, you know, there are bank accounts where you can see fractions, like a pie chart of where you spend your money. I don't need that.
That's a sad day.
Snobbish beer from wherever. I do that too much.
Yeah.
All right, Betsy.
Good for you. This is America. We're going to drink beer. No regrets.
I want to go to the $100,000 okay? beer drinking club.
Man of the people. Your watch probably costs less than $20. Good for you. Own that.
Stop. You're making me blush. All right. Thank you, Betsy. This was fun. This is a good... way to kick off our new series. So.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So until next time.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.